Thank you, Leo. Sounds quite intimate, really. You're in a den, like a private space that only we know about. That might be nice to kind of convey the atmosphere here. So good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone, wherever you are. And I'd like to also welcome those people who might be listening to this on a recording at some time in the future. Just further to the backstory of being a vet elder, it's 25 years, in fact, and Leo knows this, but today is, in fact, my final day. So it's been rather kind of serendipitous, a coincidence that Leo asked me to do this presentation. I asked what day. He said March the 27th, and I said it's my last day. So it's very timely. So I've got a bit to say, and I'll try and make it interesting and entertaining. Obviously, the question on screen is what we're going to be looking at. And I wonder for each one of us, you know, just ask myself, I don't need to see your answer, do you consider yourself to be an innovator? I know I didn't for many years until someone convinced me that I actually was. Could you all just in the text chat write where you're from? So just your organisation and where you are in Australia, just to get a sense of, okay, Kangan, Cameron, Bianca and Monica. Sunny TAFE, another person from Kangwin, so lots of TAFE people. AMES in Melbourne, Dora, I think we probably know each other. Okay, so it would seem the majority of the people present are TAFE, but not everybody by any means. Okay, thanks everybody. For the record, I'm in Adelaide, where it's a lovely, warm, sunny day. Just a point of process, if you want to say something at any time, as Leo said, we encourage people to communicate, certainly in the text chat. And between us, Leo and I will try and keep track of what you're saying in there and address any questions or comments. If you'd like to make a spoken comment or ask a question at any time, there's that little hands up icon above our list of names. If you click that, it signals to me that you want to say something. So don't be shy. Just if you want to say something, jump in at any time. There will be time at the end, I hope, sort of 5 or 10 minutes or so for us to deal with questions and comments, but you don't have to wait until the end. If you've got a thought or a comment, let's get it off your chest, and I'm about to get quite a bit off my chest. So, look, the simple answer to this question, of course, is vet innovation in the vet sector possible? Yes. I guess the more salient question for this context is about what happens from here on, and I would say it's absolutely getting harder to be an innovator in the vet sector. What I'm going to do is just whiz through some examples of what I consider to be innovative approaches in the vet sector over the last 10 or 15 years, look at what's happening right now, and suggest the path that we might follow if we want to be an innovative sector into the future. So that's the very general plan. Just a kind of quick, quirky, curious look at history. I think it's always nice to look back on this day and what happened on this day in history. And you can see there, on March the 27th, these things were either invented or patented, starting with shoelaces in 1790 to the first blood transfusion in 1914, and interesting things like the corkscrew and the urinal. So there you go. I'm not going to define innovation, but I'm just going to say this, and I think it's fairly safe bet that no one's going to argue with this. Innovation involves time to play an experiment. It involves an element of risk, and it involves possible failure. We'll return to this later in the presentation, but just keep these in mind as we proceed. I know some of you are going to think, look, innovation isn't just about technology. Most of what I'm going to talk about over the next 40 minutes is technology driven, or certainly about innovation where technology has a significant role. But sometimes technology is not the direct focus, but it's the thing that has enabled the innovation. So I'm going to look at some examples, and beginning with a very popular one right now, which is flipped learning. Flipped learning doesn't have its focus directly on technology, but it's the presence of internet technology that has made it possible for us to send materials to students ahead of class, where when people come together in a class in the face-to-face situation, we're doing something different. So technology has enabled this change, but it's not the focus of the change. We'll return to flipped learning later, but I also want to mention that sometimes innovation can come about accidentally. The TAFE SA Dental School were asked, and this is particularly relevant in the current climate of cost cutting, they were asked to deliver the same content with half the number of classes. And the lecturers were just told, go away and work it out. The lecturers came up with a plan which involved sending materials to students, teaching instructional materials to students ahead of the time, ahead of the class, and in class they would just concentrate on application and address questions and comments of students. Does it sound like flipped learning? Of course it does. I asked these lecturers, have you ever heard of flipped learning? And they said, what's that? So, necessity being the mother of invention, this group of lecturers just came up with a model they thought would work in the new regime of less funding, less classes, less resources, and came up with a model that they actually said, I think it works better than the old model anyway. So innovation doesn't always have to be conscious or deliberate. Another example that's been going on for a long, long time, and certainly in TAFEs across Australia, were practice firms, what became known as virtual enterprises. And these were virtual worlds in a sense, but not virtual in the sense that it was online. They were make-believe worlds. They were pretend or simulated role plays. This is a screenshot of a practice firm that it was on a campus at Port Adelaide, and you can see there's a shop counter there. There's a computer which looks like it might be a till or a cash register. There are goods on the shelves, and people who are familiar with practice firms and virtual enterprise will know that it allowed students to get almost real-world practice at dealing with customers, taking money, handling accounts, looking at stock, ordering stock. And these were a great example of innovation that really had nothing to do with technology. There were communities of practice that grew up around practice firms that communicated via the internet, but the actual process on campus with students getting real-world, simulated real-world experience had nothing to do with technology. Here's another one where technology is a feature, but it's not really in the background. And you wouldn't kind of advertise this method of teaching as especially innovative. But I want to make a couple of points here. One is the vet sector is really, really fortunate because by and large our classes are small. They're not quite as small as the one in this picture. There's about 12 students in this class behind the photograph. But you can see that it's a class about the responsible service of alcohol. There's a lot of props. Again, there's real-world materials in there. In this case, lots of bottles of alcohol, where students get to mix drinks and learn about the subject at hand, the responsible service of alcohol. Behind the lecturer, there's a Moodle screen, which is the underpinning knowledge and maybe the assessment activities that class needs to do after the face-to-face session. This is a really effective model. Small classes, stuff in the classroom that people can get their hands on and simulate the real world, and they've got the technology, in this case Moodle or a learning management system, in the background to back up with the underpinning knowledge. It's a really simple but very effective and I think quite innovative example. It's very common across vet. To go way back, in this period between 1997 and 2002, I think it's fair to say that VET in Australia led the way with e-learning. TAFE South Australia was in fact the very first organisation outside of North America to adopt WebCT. Some of you will know that WebCT is the precursor to Blackboard. Things like Janison and Moodle are in the same space, but WebCT was the first learning management system that was of any significant impact across the world, and TAFE and the VET sector were very fast to get onto it and really were trailblazers in this space back at the turn of the century. Marvin came out of the Northern Territory health sector. You might remember that when we used Microsoft Word, PowerPoint or Office products in the past, there was that annoying paperclip character that used to jump out and say, can I help you? Is there anything you need to know? J. Easterby Wood built on that character and developed what are now quite common across the internet, talking avatar heads. So when you go onto a page of content, this avatar talks to you, maybe they crack jokes, they smile, they feel like, you know, your own personal assistant. So he called his Marvin. It was so successful that it was actually bought by Microsoft. So if you go looking for Marvin, the talking avatar, it'll take you to a Microsoft site. A fantastic example of an innovation in the vet sector that was extremely successful. Whenever you go down the road of user-generated content, that is, you're using materials that students create for your delivery, you're on the road to innovation. The two examples here on screen are from hairdressing and from building and carpentry. In the hairdressing scenario in the top photograph, a student has taken a photograph of another student who's out in a salon or a studio cutting hair, and these photographs are posted back to Facebook. So this becomes part of their content. So students can share thoughts on the photographs and the videos that have been uploaded via mobile phones to Facebook. The teacher can bring this into class. So there's content that's generated by students which becomes part of the teaching process. In the other example, it's a screenshot from a video created by a student of one of his peers demonstrating competence in the safe use of hand and power tools. Just a comment there on the internet connection. I don't seem to have any issues on my end. It seems to be smooth, but Blackboard collaborator is usually quite good at... I might sound like a chipmunk every now and then. I might start sounding very high-pitched and my voice will be really fast, but that's it catching up with the audio. The good news is, on playback, these things are always seamless. So in this video here, this was a lecturer who, rather than go around and watch each student perform or show the use of this power tool, he put students into pairs and got them to film each other using the power tool. And there were two results from this. One, the lecturer was really impressed with the fact that the students and their videos demonstrably showed that they could use a power tool, so he was able to tick off the competence. And what he now had was a bank of resources that he could use for teaching purposes for future classes. A really smart, innovative use of technology and capitalising on user-generated content. Point of view technology has been around for quite a while now in the vet sector, POV. This is a screenshot from a YouTube video where a student is being filmed fitting a service gauge somewhere in remote Australia, and that has been sent in as evidence towards assessment. In this next example, this is a little point of view video narrated by a student as he wandered around the roof where he was working, explaining what he'd done and why he did what he did on this roof to demonstrate that he was competent at fitting battens on a roof. Now, I don't know what battens are, but this was how this student chose to submit some of his evidence towards a competency. Yes, well, the edge protection. Good question, Warren. You could use this for other purposes then, couldn't you? So here's some content that might be good who demonstrates a student's competence in some things. It might demonstrate bad practice in other areas. Virtual worlds had their day in the sun, and they haven't gone, but they've certainly waned. I guess 5 years ago, virtual worlds were the flavour of the month, and everybody seemed to be using them and creating these 3D worlds that people went into and walked around as avatars. I'd just like to mention in particular Gipps TAFE in rural Victoria. They did a number of fascinating things, but the one that I think that had the most impact for me, for students studying drug and alcohol counselling, they actually created a space that mirrored the experience of someone suffering an episode of schizophrenia. And when you walked into that space in Second Life, it was terrifying, and it gave you a very real sense of what a student or what a person who's got this condition suffers when they walk through daily life. So a very powerful use of these virtual worlds, and I think they'll be back when NBN is a fact of life across the country. This is not so much about teaching, this is just an individual taking it upon himself to create something which we all needed, in fact the world needed. Peter Shanks is from, I think it's now called TAFE Polytechnic, or TAS Polytechnic, whatever TAFE Tasmania is now called. And he created this software to find Creative Commons images on Flickr. And it's still there, and it's a great little tool. So it will turn up the images via a search, thank you Roof, TAS TAFE, and it provides the metadata that you need to paste that image and the relevant attribution into your materials. So Peter just did this out of the kindness of his heart, really, and I'll come back to Peter Shanks later in the session. Stefan Schmidt is one of a long list of people in the vet sector who've worked away on this question of assessment in the field, as a lot of assessment takes place in workplaces or in quite remote locations. It was really necessary for people to have some kind of system where they didn't have to write things down on paper and then re-enter that data when they kind of got back to base. And I'd like to pay tribute here to Jim Higgs and team in Tasmania, who for many years had the QTI player do this similar function in a world before iPads and before iPhones. But Stefan, who now works for State Emergency Services here in Adelaide, did a lot of work in using iPads and PDS for this same process. So you're out in the field, you're observing a student's work, there's a list of competencies on your iPad or your phone, you mark them off, and using the PDF you can actually put in an electronic signature, as can the student. So when you go back to base, it's all there, gathered for you, assembled in a nice, neat package. Great innovative work for something which is obviously crucial to the vet sector. This New South Wales TAFE Skills Locker, this is a student-based tool where they can actually, again, they've got all the list of the competencies they're studying or have achieved in a one convenient space. There's evidence in there about how they did it. It's signed off by a lecturer, so it's kind of like an e-portfolio, but it's very much tailored to competencies, and it's a great little tool for students in New South Wales TAFE. Quick reference to this one, the Pharmacy Guild of Australia did a lot of work in a framework project, an Australian Flexible Learning Framework project, on the role of online peer assessment. The workshop tool in Moodle, for those who might know Moodle, is designed to use peer assessment, and in this project they actually used peer assessment not just as a kind of a formative exercise, formative assessment, it was actually part of the summative of assessment. It was actually built into the final kind of real assessment of the unit in Promote Team Effectiveness. So there's a lot of examples. Noting Leo's comment there about peer assessment in MOOCs. Yep. This is a screenshot from a newspaper article about a year ago, and it talks about tradies who are also nerds. And of course, if you combine tradie with nerd, you get turd. So there are now out there in the workplace turds. And as it says there, that on that last sentence, that a survey conducted of about 500 Australian tradies found half of them go to their work sites with laptops, and about 40% relied on smartphones and tablets such as iPads. So out there in the real world, at least half of the tradespeople out there managing their business are using mobile technology. I don't think it's the case that... I guess my point here is, I think there's a bit of a gap between the use of technology in the training space and what's actually happening in the real world. There's a bit of a perception around that in the training environment, it's actually difficult to get trade people involved in the use of technology and in the use of innovation. I don't think that's actually true, but I think there's something about the training space which hinders it, whereas out in the real world, they're up and running. Technology is a part of normal life now, out in the field, in trade areas. I want to mention this one because I think this is almost like a blueprint for what we should all do. Blue Dog Training are a company, a private RTO in Queensland. They've won the RTO or Private Provider of the Year a couple of times. And I don't think it was Private Provider Trainer of the Year. I think it was Trainer of the Year. So you can see there on screen, they have a number of things that they do that when combined into a whole and a holistic approach is a very effective form of assessment. So it's not, no one of these things is particularly innovative, but if you combine the whole lot, it is. So there are quizzes, there's an e-portfolio, there's interviews with students and their supervisors, there's a variety of tasks, there's photographic evidence, and I like this. It really comes down to something so simple sometimes. They build effective relationships with their learners. So when their learners submit assessments online and someone says, well, how do you know that written report is the student's work? You can see what the lecturer says there, or the trainer. I know because it's just one piece of assessment. I have developed a relationship with that student. So basically, cheating is out of the question. They've designed an assessment process which is holistic. It has a lot of elements to it. So a student can't cheat, even if they wanted to. So when a lecturer comes to me and says, how can I stop people cheating? How can I guarantee that students aren't cheating? I always go back to them and say, well, I think you need to redesign your assessment. Because if your assessment relies on a kind of assessment that enables students to cheat, then it's poor design. Yes, Leo, it's asked all the time, but it is harder, it's more challenging to create assessments where this whole question of cheating is circumvented, but it's possible, and I think Blue Dog Trainer show how. So, in all of these examples, it's clear that there are pockets of excellence. And I guess I want to caution against the impression that, well, look at all these fantastic things that the vet sector has done all of these years, and it must be brilliantly innovative. And yeah, in pockets it is, but it's not the case that those examples that I've just shown represent the industry, the vet training industry as a whole. And a lot of the examples we've looked at just then were possible because they were funded by the former Australia Flexible Learning Framework, now the VET e-learning framework or something, but what used to be called affectionately the framework in a previous era had a lot of money to distribute on innovation. And what we've just looked at are a number of things that were the result of this. I'm going to pause there for a minute and just check, is there anything that people would like to say or questions before we move on to the next section, which is really looking at what's happening right now. Okay, I'm going to more or less assume that people are okay. Now I see Mike's comment, how do we sustain it? Well, we'll address this, Mike. I've got a few ideas. I don't have hard and fast answers, but I'm certainly going to suggest some ideas. So, is there a problem? And I think there is. It was also the Flexible Learning Framework that sponsored this piece of work back in 2010. What was becoming apparent is that there was a divide between practitioners, teachers, trainers, and auditors, and this would typically play out in a practitioner had used a piece of technology or a certain methodology. When it came to the auditing, the auditor didn't understand it, and they had difficulty signing off that everything was done according to the training package and accepted practice. And this research was designed to bridge that divide, and they found a number of things. It was a really good paper. And what they found, not surprisingly, in amongst everything else, was that practitioners are not sure what's acceptable to auditors, So it results in people going back to doing the standard thing, the safe and sure, the compliance route, because that the auditor understood, that there was no problem getting signed off as accepted practice, and it all leads to an unwillingness to innovate. And note up here in this screenshot, compliance is not quality. There has been progress in this area. I think the average auditor, and you do hear good stories of lecturers meeting with auditors, and the auditor does understand innovative methodology. They do understand how new technologies are used. But this comment here is from an auditor in Queensland, was in November last year. I suggest you steer away from collaborative assessment because they had no, they weren't able to sign off the lecturer's practice and the way they'd gone about it. It didn't fit the auditing mould, and this is still a problem. Around the year 2000, TAFE nationally had a teaching and learning program, a professional development program called Teaching and Learning. Back then, there was a document which described its purpose and the outcomes that were supposed to come out of this program. And I took that text and I put it into Wordle. Now, some of you will know Wordle, but if you don't, it's a great little tool because what it does, if you paste a paragraph of text into Wordle, it generates a graphic like this, and it makes the words that are used the most the biggest in the graphic. So you can see in this graphic here on screen that the most important or the most frequently used word in that document from 2000 was learning. If we fast forward to 2013 and do the same thing with the TAE certificate, the training and assessment document, put it into Wordle, look at the word that dominates. It's assessment. So assessment is now the most dominant or most frequently used word in the current professional development regime. And if you look closely, the word learning's not even in there. So what's happened in that 13 years? The vet sector has changed from being a sector that was primarily about learning to a sector that's primarily about assessment. I asked a group of lecturers, it was only about 40 or 50 lecturers, what percentage of your work time do you currently spend on managing assessment processes? And this was the result of me just hearing stories around the place of people feeling bombarded and weighed down with all this assessment business. And around half the lecturers said that they spend 25 to 50% on managing assessment processes. 16% of lecturers said that they do much more than half of their time is spent on managing assessment processes. So overall, you've got about 65, 70% of lecturers saying it's occupying, you know, a third to two-thirds of their time. When I asked lecturers, does all this requirement around managing and reporting of assessment eat away at the time you have to teach? Well, it was pretty overwhelmingly yes. Some said it's increased slightly. Half the lecturers that I spoke to said it has increased a lot. There are some lecturers who don't see it that way, but there are a majority of lecturers, certainly that I know of, they know that they are less able to concentrate on designing materials, designing lessons, because it's all about the back end, the assessment product. Some comments from lecturers about this, just looking at the ones in red, this person finds they waste a huge amount of time on bureaucracy. This person says quality requirements, note word quality, means filing assessments, tracking training plans. Down here, quality system demands multiple records of many outcomes, and this takes significant time. In my opinion, this has nothing to do with quality, but it's all done under the guise of quality. Down here, admin compliance requirements significantly reduce the time available for quality lesson planning. So You know, I could get hundreds of comments like this. And again, it's you will find people who have the opposite opinion. But I'm arguing, from my experience, the majority of people in the vet sector are feeling this, the overload and excessive requirements around assessment and reporting on assessment. Yes, Peter, you may be familiar with the Assessment for Learning initiative, which I think is wonderful, because what that does, it presents the whole process as a whole. So it's not teaching then assessment, it's assessment and learning are integrated into the same process. It sounds really easy and it sounds really obvious, but reality is a lot of lecturers still don't get it, and interestingly students don't get it, because I had a lecturer talk to me who was going through this process of using assessment for learning, and it took him a week to convince the students that this was a valid thing to do, because they would just kept saying to him, this is weird, why are you doing this? So it's about change, of course, and people are stuck in their ways, lecturers are and students are, not to mention the systemic issues. So an assessor in the Australian vet sector needs to know how to provide evidence to support your decision to approve any student competent in a unit on any particular day. In extreme cases, and thankfully it's extreme, but I have come across examples where a lecturer has to report on every student on every unit of competent every day. This is nuts. This is nuts. Why has this happened? I'm going to let that statement there at the bottom of the screen hanging. We'll maybe come back to that for another time in a different conversation. But Sugata Mitra, who will be in Australia in June for the EduTech conference in Brisbane, who came to fame through the hole-in-the-wall experiment in India, if you're familiar with that one, they put a computer in a village in India and watched what children did with no instruction, with no previous knowledge of a computer, and found out that children were able to do all sorts of interesting things. But Sugata Mitra says that this whole obsession with assessment has come about through the stupidity and short-sighted self-interest of politicians, combined with the laziness and cowardice of many who work in education, and it's a powerful and deadly brake upon change. Now, they are harsh, damning words, but honestly, I'd been thinking this for about a year, and when I saw this quote, I thought, okay, I'm not alone here. We're driven in the vet sector by politics and often by people who have very little idea of what it's like to actually teach and learn. And I think we as a vet sector have been gutless. We've been cowards. But that's my opinion. So how do we stop this? And this, you know, going back to the question earlier, how do we sustain innovation? I think we've got to stop this stuff. We've got to put a line in the sand and take some action so that it doesn't get further out of control. Greg Whitby is a headmaster, a principal of a group of 8 schools in Western Sydney. Noting Warren's comment. When they get new requests from the New South Wales Department of Innovation about some bureaucratic thing, or maybe it's an assessment thing, a new requirement that teachers have to do, the staff at Greg Whitby School sit down and collectively ask 2 questions. 1, will this improve my teaching? 2, will it reduce the amount of time I have for lessons, prepare lessons? If the answer to question 1 is no, and the answer to question 2 is yes, they send it back to the department and say, we're not refusing to do this, but if you want this information, design some other process where you get the information through some other channel, because our teachers aren't doing it. Our teachers teach. And I just think there's a whole realm of activity around assessment and reporting that we in the vet sector should be saying the thing. It's not our job. If you want the information, get someone else to do it, because it's getting in the way of effective teaching. Ken Robinson also will be at the EduTech conference in June. The wonderfully eloquent and funny Ken Robinson puts it this way. The dominant culture of education has come to focus not on teaching and learning, but testing. This leads to a culture of compliance rather than creativity. Now, he and Sugata Mitra, of course, are not talking about the Australian vet sector. They're talking about education globally, in schools, vet sector and its equivalents in other countries, and higher ed. The same thing is happening everywhere. This malaise that's crept in across the world where testing is more important than learning. Now, I know we need to have both. It's all about balance, and getting that balance correct, I think, in the Australian vet sector is way out of whack. So what needs to happen for us to be able to be innovative in the vet sector? I asked in another survey a group of staff what they thought, and here are some comments, again in red. While we have every learning experience budgeted, audited, assessed and reviewed, there will never be any true innovation. The system doesn't allow it. The second comment there argues that you've got to have an organisational culture which allows and encourages innovation. I don't see much of that around at the moment. I think I did in previous years. I don't see it anymore. Peter Shanks was the guy I referred to earlier who came up with that lovely little tool to find Creative Commons images on Flickr. So Peter, when I asked this question far and wide a few weeks ago, that what needs to happen to ensure innovation in the vet sector, this is what Peter came up with. And Peter, interestingly, didn't take it from the point of view of the individual. He took it from the point of view of the system. So here are sort of 8 points or so that Peter argues the system should be doing to make sure that we're innovative into the future. And I'm going to stop talking for a couple of minutes and allow you to read those. Now, if you're not sure what this abbreviation in that last point is, AI, it's artificial intelligence. I think we could spend a week, we could have a MOOC on these questions. I think this is a brilliant list of things that the vet sector should do, but I'm just going to leave them there for your edification, and you might like to explore some of these with your colleagues when you go back to your workplace. But I really thank Peter for that very thoughtful list. I think what we need is this. If we want to allow innovation to happen in the vet sector, we need to have a work culture and environment that allows experimentation and trialing without the requirement of success, profitability or quality. And I've been thinking for a couple of years, and I guess I didn't have the nerve, or maybe I didn't have the time to make this happen. I think someone needs to apply for funding where, in an incubator kind of model, you have real students, they're doing real competencies, but there's an acceptance by all involved that it's not subject to the same regulation, auditing and assessment that mainstream vet is subjected to. And I would love to get a kind of trial like this happening and then compare the two approaches. You know, perhaps the same set of competencies with a similar profile of student, and see whether or not the regulated model produced better or worse results than the incubator model. My money would be on the incubator model, leaving it for dead. My opinion. But that's what I think is needed. What kind of areas should we be looking at for innovation from here on? This Australian Technology Outlook for 2014 is about to be released. I'm on the advisory board of the Horizon Report, so I'm able to share these with you. These were the technologies that have been identified just in the last couple of months that are going to be on the educational horizon for the next 5 years. Some of these we've already talked about, so I'm just going to go into having a look at some of these in some detail, and this is where we kind of get into science fiction realm. But I just, again, want to pause in case there's a question or comment that someone's really wanting to share. So if you want to put a comment in the text chat or grab the microphone, please. Anyone? Cameron, I can't give you the link yet because it's not formally published until May. Look, I will check that, but my understanding is that it's kind of an open process, but it will be published in full in May, but these will be the headings. Will do, Ruth. In the context of badges and microcredits. So let's look at some of these. I've mentioned flipped learning before. I'm just going to say it again. I think it's got legs. I think there's a lot of potential to look further at the flipped model in the vet sector, because it's now more or less the blended learning is more or less the default delivery strategy. And it's not done well in a lot of cases. And I think flipped learning really has the potential to turn blended learning into something which is a lot more effective, successful, and yes, innovative. So I just wanted to mention it again. Mobile's kind of obvious, but maybe we've only just seen the beginning of what is going on in the mobile space. In the year 2012, the data showed that more than 50% of the world now access the internet via a mobile device. This is driven primarily by what's happening in the developing world, Africa in particular, and I'm glad you're back, Leo. The gurus who work in this space have one very consistent golden message, the one there in brown: develop content for mobile devices first. That most of your users, most of your students, now and into the future, are going to be looking at that content on a tablet or a phone. So get that right first, and then worry about how it looks on a desktop. If you are a Moodle user and a Moodle 2 user, then you kind of have a head start, because Moodle has apps available for all smartphones and it does a pretty good job of reformatting your content for the mobile screen. Another aspect of mobile is augmented reality, or AR. This is an example taken from the University of Canberra, and what you can see on screen there is someone holding an iPad mini with a brochure. So what this iPad mini is doing is scanning a code, kind of like a QR code, but something a little different, on this brochure. This iPad is connected to a computer wirelessly, which is connected to a projector, which is projecting a 3D model of the Mars 3D rover into the front of the room, almost like a hologram. I couldn't get a photograph of it because it was just difficult to photograph, but it was like being in science fiction. There was a full-scale model of the rover on the floor. You could walk around it, look at the various components. It would be a brilliant teaching tool. And it's just an example of where this is heading, and it's only just begun. 3D printing, I think we've all finally kind of heard, we know now where it's, what its role is. Okay, I think I lost my audio there for a minute, but I think I'm back. Leo, can you moderate? Thanks, Leo. Yeah, look, 10 years ago, this would happen twice a year. Now it happens twice a day. 3D printing. I think I read recently that they've actually printed a face, the skin of a face. They have certainly... there's Mike back again. Thank you. Sorry. 3D printing. I think they've actually printed a face. They've certainly printed an ear. And I think this is something that the vet sector should be absolutely in the vanguard with. It's about design, it's about engineering, it's about all kinds of things that are standard kind of processes in TAFE. And I think you can make a case for the fact that 3D printing is going to take up a lot of the slack with the collapse of traditional manufacturing industries in the developed world. be interesting to watch, but TAFE VET needs to be here. So the open badges and microcredits thing is this stuff. Badges have arisen in response to the need that people have to have specific skills, specific competencies, in our terminology in the vet sector, accredited. So they don't want a certificate. They don't want a whole qualification. They want, you know, this competency from that qualification. Perhaps they need a separate competency from a different qualification in what are being called skill sets. And we don't really have a process at the moment for being able to effectively document, provide to students the sorts of the information they need when it's not whole qualifications thereafter. So badges are a possible solution to this. Yes, they look very simple and sort of childish, and they are similar to the sorts of things that used to happen and probably still do with Girl Guides, Boy Scouts, where you have badges down the sleeve on your arm. But these badges have metadata behind them. So if you put a badge like this on your e-portfolio or some web space, and a user clicks on it, it shows you what the competency is that it represents, how the evidence was gathered, who was the issuing authority, how it was verified. So it's quite legitimate. So they look kind of Mickey Mouse and simple, but the technology behind them and the thinking behind them is quite sophisticated. And I think badges to authorise, verify microcredits is going to be, well, we'll just see a lot more of it. And VET and the list that Peter Shanks provided earlier actually said this, we need to be in this space. Wearable computing. Well, this is a tsunami waiting to happen. It's already begun. The picture there shows a Fitbit, which if you wear it while you're doing things, tracks your pulse, your blood pressure, your temperature, your heart rate, and all sorts of other things. But where it gets a little bit scary and science fiction-like is with embedded technology. There are some places in the world now, China has a Fitbit, that you don't get entry unless you have an embedded chip. So there are places in the world that want you to have what we do to our dogs and cats. That's the way that they check who you are. Now, can I just get a hands up? Would you wear an embedded chip? Would you be happy to do that? So above our names, there's the tick, and can you select yes or no? Would you be happy to have an embedded chip? Leo says yes. I'm seeing lots of crosses, mostly crosses. Ruth says yes. So not an idea that if we are representative of the population that is, we're not quite ready for it yet. For what purpose, Mike? Well, I'll tell you a little anecdotal story. Alex Hayes, some of you may know. Alex is very much concerned in this space. Thanks, Leo. He rang me up one night about a year ago after he'd been to a conference where there were police, military and security people. And what worried Alex is that the conversation at that conference was not about if this would happen, it was about when. So he argues that police, military, security, they want it. So, yep, just moments away from being cyborgs, at least variations of. Before I go to Google Glass, I just want to mention this one. This is brilliant. I mean, these are people in Melbourne who have invented electrodes which are implanted in your brain, and they monitor your brain activity. So they can actually detect different or abnormal brain activity. So if you get seizures or Parkinson's disease or something, they can detect in advance when these things are likely to happen. And happened again. I think I'm back. Can you just confirm that I'm back, Leo? Okay, thanks, Evie. So, I think what I'd like to do at this point, we've got about 5 minutes left, is just jump forward to a couple of slides that kind of reiterate what I think are the main things. I mean, I've got lots of examples of here of really interesting things that are happening. I will actually bring up the next slide because I think Google Glass is the one we just have to prepare for. Point of view technology, we saw examples of earlier in the training space. We're about to embark in a world, and I think we'll see it in Australia before the end of this year, that people will be walking down the street using these devices, recording everything that they see and hear. And like it or not, that's going to be our future. Not the whole future, but quite a lot of it. Clayton Christensen wrote a book called Disruptive Innovation. And he used the word disruptive in a positive sense. He said disruptive in the world of innovation is exactly what you need to drive creative activity, that you've got to disrupt the status quo. Leo, I'll mention that at the end, but certainly the slides will be available either on SlideShare or I can send them directly to you for furthering on to whoever wants them. No problem. Christensen says that, believe it or not, he said the only way you're going to have innovation in the education sector is via the incubator approach, because existing systems are so rigid and regulated that no true innovation can happen. You've got to move outside and you've got to have funding with no strings attached. So he came to the same conclusion. After writing a long book on disrupting class, he suggests that the way the education sector, all sectors, need to be innovative and reform is to develop the reforms outside of the system and then bring them in. So, innovation, as I said at the beginning, involves these things. Charles Kettering says 99% of success is built on failure. He's an American inventor. Others have written about this and even quantified the risk of, or the element of failure versus risk, or the proportion of failure versus success. And so let's take Alexander Bell, the guy who invented the telephone, as an example. And researchers in this field will say Bell would have failed 8 times before he got a working prototype of the phone. And that's about the ratio. Basically, in the vet sector, we don't deal with risk. We are risk averse. Everything about the way the vet sector is set up is to avoid risk. And yet, every book you read about innovation will say it involves possible failure, it involves risk. Okay, I'm back on the other computer. So, and I think I'll finish off here, Leo, and I think the point's made. So, time for a few questions and some discussion if there are questions and comments. So, over to you folks, and sorry about the dropouts.